Oh, hi there. This is M.P. Fitzgerald, author of A Happy Bureaucracy, and I'm pretending to play the jazz piano. You know, advertisements were invented by the devil to make Ayn Rand happy, and no one wants to make Ayn Rand happy. But audio production is expensive, so to keep commercials off this podcast, I've got all three ebooks in the Happy Bureaucracy series rolled into one for the price of a single book, which honestly is the best way to support this podcast. Just check the description for a link and tell your friends about the crazy shit you have been listening to have less friends. Thanks. And now, for something completely different.
Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland. The Happy Bureaucracy, Book 2. By M.P. Fitzgerald. Narrated by Gary Bennett. Author's note. Strewn between drug use, groin malice, and cursing on a level tantamount to sacrilege are even more gratuitous mentions of bureaucracy. These bureaucratic references may not be for the weak of heart. Also, child endangerment. Did I mention child endangerment? Chapter 9. Rabia unlatched the top of her kit bag after looking for it nearly blind. There was no moon out that night. There was no light. She fished inside of her kit bag until she found a solitary salt shaker filled with cocaine, and she nearly jumped in fright when the quiet voice of dinner broke the silence. "What's that?" the child asked. Of course she was awake. Children are never asleep when you need them to be. Something to keep me awake while I go looking for some friends, Robbie replied without looking at her. They were parked on the side of the road, having crested the mountain only minutes ago. Driving in the night naturally made Robbie nervous, but given the mysterious cars flanking her employers, and possibly Arthur, she risked the act with abandon. The mountain was empty of trees now, with a thick layer of soot and ash in their stead. The moonless night had darkened the mountain completely. Any light made by the shark past this point would be egregious, especially seeing as Rabia planned to sneak up on whoever was out there. There was little doubt in her mind that the caravan of cars she had seen had cut their lights as well, and there was no use setting up a surprise attack if you broadcast yourself to everyone around you. The darkness was so complete that Rabia had hoped that if dinner had woken, it would be only briefly, and that she would fall back asleep, comforted by the fall of night. She was wrong. "Can I have some?" dinner asked, sweet as honey. "No, these are drugs and they are mine. We talked about this," Rabia replied, still avoiding the child's glare. "They can keep you awake?" "Some of them. Others can help you fall asleep. See the face of God, or the devil, for that matter. All of them are bad. Stay away from them." And with that, Rabia latched the drug kit closed and pocketed the salt shaker in her cargo shorts. It was very hard to see the child, but Rabia still felt guilty taking the drugs in front of her. She would have to wait until later. "They can make you fall asleep?" Dinner asked, with an infuriating innocence. "Can I have some of those?" Rabia considered it. Having her knocked out would make this much easier. There was no way to know if the kid would stay put while Rabia went out on the prowl, and she would be safest here. Half a trank would probably do it. Hell, most waste kids her age were already addicted to two kinds of drugs. It was actually surprising that dinner had no habits of her own. This would be an exception anyways, nowhere near enough to make it a habit. The familiar burden of guilt was almost as complete as the darkness surrounding them. Rabia unlatched her kit once more. "Don't tell Arthur I gave you this," she said as she pulled out a single capsule. "That is, if we ever see him again." Rabia handed her the trank, finding that the girl's hand was already out and open. "When do we get to see Arthur?" Dinner said as her little hand clutched the pill. "Hopefully soon," was all that Rabia answered on the subject, doing her best to keep the worry out of her voice. Rabia searched the shark's trunk for weaponry, and after staring at the harpoon gun for an obscene amount of time, decided to take a single hand cannon a much smaller pistol, some grenades, and a knife. The knife was the only thing she planned on using. "Listen," Rabia said as she closed the trunk. "I'm going to be out for a bit. I want you to stay here." Dinner stood silently beside her. "Can you shoot?" Rabia asked. It was almost an insult to ask a child of the wastes that question. Anyone past the age of 4 had likely fired a gun at someone at least once. Dinner nodded. It was too dark for Rabia to see her expression, but she guessed it was probably an indignant one. "Good. I'm leaving a pistol with you just in case, but you probably won't need it. Get comfy and take only half of that pill." "When will you be back?" Dinner asked. The child had endless questions. Patience was not a trait Rabia was known for. Going from cold to hot at the drop of a hat? Absolutely. But patience? This was as foreign to her as empathy was to a psychopath. She was doing her best to try for the child, but there would be no A for effort here. "When you wake up," Rabia said through clenched teeth, "so the faster you take that pill, the faster I'll be back." Dinner scurried back to the shark, and the tarp moved with an audible crinkle as she opened the door. When Rabia heard the door close, she headed out. It could be all night until she had come to the resting place of the caravan. Traversing the mountain by foot and in the dark would take some time. She was already glad for the drug she had yet to take, but waited until she was far away enough that her new habit of guilt subsided. It would not just keep her awake. It would also keep her alert, and it would keep the boredom at bay. This last part was most important of all. Though their journey so far had been nerve-wracking because of the urgent nature of it, 2 days' worth of a drive with a child was not exactly entertaining. If anything, she looked forward to the drug to quell that boredom. So Rabia Duke walked through the ash, occasionally patting her side pocket to feel for the salt shaker. Her eyes were finally beginning to adjust. The stillness of the night should have amplified the sound of her footprints, yet she heard none. The mountain's ash beneath her had muted her footsteps. This was both good and bad. Good because it meant she could sneak up on her prey. Bad because it meant that she could be snuck up on. After pondering the ash beneath her, she was suddenly grateful that there was no moon. The light would have been nice, but it was likely that the ash beneath her would act like snow, the sheer amount of white reflecting and enhancing the light. It would probably illuminate the whole mountain, and she would be an easy one to spot. She kept walking, and her guilt had finally started to wane, but it was being replaced by doubt and fear. This wicked mission she was on could be a pointless one if Arthur was already dead, which was a strong possibility. Given the age of the tracks that the tax army had left behind, Arthur and the army would likely have been at Slaver City for a whole day. The fact that a fleet of white vans was now climbing the mountain either meant that the battle was yet to be won, or they were all dead. This last part seemed unlikely. The tax army would certainly crush the slavers with their superior supplies and firepower, but that did not mean that Arthur could not be a casualty. The fact that the slavers were trying to flank Boyd and his men was a good sign, for at least it meant that Boyd still had men to flank. Rabia desperately hoped that Arthur was among them. The task was almost Sisyphean. The odds of Arthur being alive were slim, which was something that Rabia had known even before she set out to try and rescue him. If he did not die by the hand of a slaver, would he not be assassinated by Bond's lackey? No one had tried to kill her again yet. But hadn't she gone to some length to make sure that tracking her was harder? If Arthur were dead and she ruined the surprise attack tonight like she planned, what would be the point? She was a marked woman and had very little allegiance to the IRS now that it wanted Arthur and herself dead. Wouldn't it be better to take the shark and dinner in the opposite direction and try her luck at finding another caravan that needed a good sheriff? It made much more sense than what she was doing now. Rabia trekked on, and she did so despite all common sense. She did so because Arthur was her friend. She did so because he was more than just a friend. He was the only person to ever return her affections. Melody, the slave she had freed, certainly faked it for her. But Arthur was the first who seemed to do so genuinely. he was a total dork, probably mad with a specific type of OCD, and incompetent at anything but menial office work. But he was also kind and compassionate and brave. She trekked on, because if there was the slightest chance that he was alive, well, she had to take it. Rabia's hike through the ghostly moon-like mountain, swallowed by the dark of night, had three beats to it. March, cocaine, rest. The last beat was something that the cocaine was supposed to keep at bay, but the change in altitude had made her weak and dizzy. She had not acclimated, and the hike demanded more oxygen than the thin air would supply. So it was during a rest when Rabia thought she had heard something behind her. Her hand cannon was out in a flash. There was nothing. She knew better than to hand wave such a thing, and kept her guard up. But when something failed to happen, she went back to that first beat. March. She heard nothing else during her journey. Maybe it was just her raw nerves made more so by the uppers. She sniffled from the drug and decided that the cocaine was probably a big factor. Rabia was not traveling through the mountain in pursuit of her prey blind. The cars had to follow the road, as the rest of the mountain was nearly impassable by anything save for a unimog. Further, she too had been in a position traveling this mountain when she had to find a place to hide with Arthur during their census foray. She also knew the best place to hide, and if her prey was thinking the same way, then she knew just where to find them. After an hour's journey, Rabia was within minutes of the Horseshoe Rock Formation that had acted as refuge to her and Arthur not so long ago. It was just enough out of the road's way that one could easily drive past it without a thought, but close enough to make driving to it a breeze. The boulders were tall enough to hide anything save for an 18-wheeler, and the clearing wide enough to hide nearly a dozen cars. If the slavers had not chosen this spot, then maybe her job would be easier than she thought, because that meant that they were dumb as hell. It would be a hassle to find them if they weren't here, but she did have all night, and a salt shaker's worth of powder. Rabia avoided the entryway of the rock formation and kept a safe and quiet distance. She listened. She heard nothing. Either they were asleep or not there. Both made it safe to approach. Her small frame made her light on her feet, and the ash beneath her muted her steps even more. She walked up to one of the rock walls and slowly began to climb it. Where the ground of the mountain was white with ash, the granite rocks she now climbed were smeared with dark soot. This made it harder to grip, and more than once her hand slipped, smearing the black soot off to reveal the gray rock beneath. She did not clear the rocks immediately when she got to the top, and elected instead to peek just slightly above them. Then she spotted them. A diverse fleet of mutated cars was parked in a semicircle, five in total. Whatever make and model of cars they used to be was hard to fathom, as each was now mostly random junk that had been welded onto them. If monster trucks were living creatures, these would be the nightmare children they would spawn. The shark would fit right in, because not too long ago it was among them. Scattered through the inside of the semicircle were 10 sleeping slavers cocooned in tattered sleeping bags. She had her work cut out for her. Rabia cleared the rocks, then slowly began her descent on the other side. If Rabia's acts of violence were on a resume, killing men in their sleep would be at the top, just under, burned down a fucking mountain. Her knife found its familiar place in her hand. She stalked silently toward the camp. She sniffled from the drug. One of the slavers was upright from the noise in an instant. There was nowhere for her to hide. Shit. Who the fuck are you? The slaver asked, scurrying for his gun. The other slavers roused from their slumbers. Oh well, Rabia thought, placing her knife back at her side. I wanted to use the grenades anyway.
About the author. M.P. Fitzgerald is an author and humorist dedicated to injecting the feverish gonzo style into fiction. You can get Memos from the Wasteland, which is the official prequel to this book, free. It contains hilariously bleak office drama, Rabia's diary, and Arthur's last letter from his father. To get your copy, just head over to his website at mpfitzgerald.art. You'll also get free updates on future audiobooks and more. We hope you have enjoyed A Happy Bureaucracy by M.P. Fitzgerald, narrated by Gary Bennett. Text copyright 2019 by M.P. Fitzgerald. Production copyright 2021 by M.P. Fitzgerald.
Music by Dustmice. Available on all streaming services. And dustmice.bandcamp.com.